The Behavioral Corner is produced in cooperation with Retreat Behavioral Health, where healing happens. Hi and welcome. I'm Steve Martorano, and this is the Behavioral Corner. You're invited to hang with us as we discuss the ways we live today, the choices we make, the things we do, and how they affect our health and well-being. So you're on the corner, the Behavioral Corner. Please hang around a while. Hi, everybody. Welcome again. It's me, Steve Martorano, hanging on the Behavioral Corner. Gee, I hope you know about us, but if you don't, I'll tell you briefly and modestly. This is a podcast about everything, because everything is what affects our behavioral health. It is all made possible by our underwriting partners, Retreat Behavioral Health. You can find more about them down the road. We're going to take a look at a fascinating topic that sounds brand new, but in fact, it is a very, very old story. It's the intersection of technology and the practice of medicine. I dare say that those intersections are as old as Hippocrates. I mean, it includes everything from the stethoscope to MRIs. Whenever there's been a technical advance that could benefit or move medicine forward, medicine would adopt it and carry on from there. So there's nothing new about talking about the latest innovation technologically that is going to impact not only medicine, but everything, and that is artificial intelligence. But I do believe, after having read some of what our guest has written and what I read myself about the power of AI, we're maybe at some kind of inflection point because of the awesome potential for artificial intelligence to change everything. And we're going to take a look at what that means in terms of medicine with our guest, Jim Keane. Jim is the CEO of a company called Molecular U. That's Y-O-U. We'll find out what that company does. He actually is a serial entrepreneur. I love that phrase. It sounds sinister, but it's not. And he's here because he has some strong feelings and some predictions about AI and medicine. Jim, thanks for joining us on the corner.
You bet, Steve. Glad to be here.
So I think I got that right, that, you know, medicine's been looking for new and different things in different forms since the beginning of time. What makes AI different, if it's different?
I think the promise and also potential danger of AI is that you're in a way giving away decision-making authority. And it's how you really decide who you want to be responsible for different parts of, say, in medicine service delivery. Like, should the AI take the part of the doctor, or should the AI just be the person who checks you in? Should the AI make the diagnosis? So there's all these things that you need to check the box on, because medicine is actually a complex set of steps that happen. And you need to be super thoughtful about who you give authority up to, who has the license and makes the call. And then, you know, what parts do you think can free a doctor up? You know, because like the potential, there's a joke from a medical conference I was at about 15 years ago, and they were talking about electronic health records and all that, and the promise of them. And the doctor said, yeah, you know, what's great about EHRs is I'm now doing tasks that take me a half hour that I never had to do before.
Exactly. Right, right, right. We have no problem accumulating this data. We just, nobody pays any attention to
right.
it. Yeah. Before, I want to get into the weeds on all of that, but I've gotten ahead of us here a little bit. Tell us about Molecular U.
Yeah. So that kind of starts with a little bit of my backstory. Mm-hmm. Is when I left a business school in the early 90s, I decided I didn't want to go work for a large company, and I wanted to get involved in startups. And that wasn't very popular back then. So I joined up with a health tech startup. I went through that. I discovered fraud at the startup, and I ended up becoming the CEO at 29 because I reported it to the board. And then I orchestrated the sale, and I was kind of hooked on doing startups. But I finally got to do my own. I had this big checklist of things not to do. And that was this company called Sapien Health Network. And that became actually, when we merged with them, the consumer-facing business, the WebMD. And so the thing that's been great about digital health and just being in consumer digital health is I've had the privilege of seeing every single step. So back in the 90s, the big step was, let's democratize access to data by pasting a browser over it so that you don't have to go ask a doctor or a nurse you know, what's this mean? I can go look it up myself. And that was fairly revolutionary back then. And so over time, you've had more and more of this digital health come in, into the fray, and I've gotten to see every step. Now, most recently, I decided to start a company called Wellness FX in 2010, and that was to democratize access to diagnostics, blood diagnostics for consumers. And we ended up selling these packages. You didn't have to go ask a doctor. You could just book it online. And then you get bundled with it a 20-minute telehealth consult. So we were pretty groundbreaking at the time. And a lot of this work we did led to a lot of other companies being formed. And I ended up having to sell that company for a variety of reasons. When I sold it, I been invited up as a guest speaker at the Precision Medicine Conference in British Columbia. And I met a bunch of really amazing world-leading scientists, because after the genome was sequenced, you had to go sequence the transcriptome, which was RNA. And then that followed with the proteome and then the metabolome. And so all those things are in the chain. And so the promise of molecular medicine really was highlighted by this amazing group of people. But back then, it was like tens of thousands of dollars and multiple tubes of blood to run. But over time, and I became an advisor to them for the past 9 years. And I worked at a Blue Cross Blue Shield after that. But I still kept in contact with them. And I was checking in with them about a year ago. And they said, you know, we've had kind of tough going here in Canada. But we, you know, we've gotten the cost of this down sub $100. It's a small tube of blood. It's easy to draw. And so everything's gotten scalable. And I said, you know, the U.S. has actually got a lot of places where this would be readily taken up. So that's how I became CEO of the company. But I've known the scientists and the people there for over 9 or 10 years. And so the promise of doing this, the way to think about it is your genes are your architecture, right? And unless you're in a secret government program, your genes aren't changing. Yeah,
right,
so,
right.
But they're possibility. So then all the choices, that's about 10 to 15% of all your total health outcomes are driven by your genes. The rest of it's actually the type of healthcare you get and your personal choices you make. And yeah. So that leads to the ongoing synthesis of your proteins or your stack of about 25,000 proteins and about 75,000 metabolites. And the way those read out on a second by second basis will indicate if you're going through a good time or a bad time in your life, if you're making good dietary choices, if you're smoking, not smoking, drug abuse, all that stuff, it gets read out on your proteins and your metabolites. So the thing that's intrigued people forever is what if you could cheaply and easily at the molecular level read this stuff out? You would see things happening far in advance, 5, 10, even 15 years before you actually had conventional symptomology come up from what we do right now. And so that's the thing that's always been the hook for me, and the fact that it's gotten cheap and scalable. And now we're in this golden age. Our current assay, it's kind of think of it like a chip, has 250 biomarkers that have been validated. We're about to release the next version. It's going to have about 825 on it. So it's just this remarkable outpouring of scientific research. And this decade is going to become known in the future as probably the golden age when all these things started getting unlocked. And the promise here is it's going to personalize increasingly and make it easy to see what's going on. So I'll pause there. I just said a lot. But
No, it's good. It's good. It sets this. We certainly now understand why you're excited about what you see now, because you've been looking at this for a very long period of time. Most of us have come in contact with AI overnight, and it's baffling and sometimes scary and certainly not well understood. But I think I understand what you're saying. This has been a process that started a long time ago. What's different now is that technology has changed. And as you said, made it vastly more robust, cheaper, and faster. And I think I understand now what you mean when you say that AI potentially a goal, one of the goals, is to move from being a reactive practice to a predictive practice. Give us a little more explanation for that, because on some level it sounds like fortune telling. You know, it's funny about genetics. Most people approach genetics in the way I do. The family traits and genes I think I have that I think are valuable, like maybe longevity, or I still got my hair, I think that's cool. But other parts I go, no, genes don't have anything to do with it. So if I understand you, genes are important, but they're not utterly determinative about how we'll wind up.
A lot of your personal choices dictate how your body decides to express your overall genetic code. So imagine like an architect delivered you a set of plans.
Right.
And you got a contractor. Let's say it was a contractor who used really substandard materials, built it on poor land, and then didn't take care of the house. You would end up with a really pretty crappy house, right? Let's say the architect, though, is a design genius, but the contractor really had a sense of artistry to him, used great materials and had a flair to it. And it became a signature house that, you know, everybody wanted to live in and buy. Those are the same house plans, right? Mm-hmm. But they got expressed differently. So that's almost the same process that I'm talking about biologically as well. Now, the other breakthrough, to say where the AI came in. Right now, there's about 1 million new pieces of creditable clinical and scientific research coming out that identify, like, here's a marker or here's something you didn't know about. And it's beyond human comprehension right now to be able to constantly find that and make sure that some obscure scientist who just made a discovery has that incorporated into our overall Weltanschauung. And so you couldn't do that without AI. And so the other part that the company really has revolutionized, I think, is in the last 9 years, they put together this machine learning apparatus that sits on top of all the scientific journals and medical journals. And it vacuums up all this data. So whenever a new marker is discovered, it doesn't just go into some dusty warehouse, digital warehouse, but it gets surfaced. And then we'll actually, the way it makes it on our assay is we go out and see if we can replicate the results by running it through our testing system.
Well, so let me ask you that we got to get back to, you know, we've been talking about the ghosts in the machine and what they're capable of, which seems like magic. But where's in this specific case, where does the doctor stand? I mean, the machines may know all this information, may in fact be even able to predict it in a certain way. Where does the physician come in to that equation?
Yeah. So that was the other problem that the company addressed in the last 10 years, because I took one of the first tests way back when, and I got my results. And they were unlike anything I'd ever seen as far as depth and complexity. But the doctor and I'm not a doctor by any means, I just happened to have been in this field for a long time. Mm-hmm. I'm asking, he said, it looks super interesting. I have no idea what it means. So right there, you can see the problem, right? If it's data, it's not information. And so part of the job has been now in the last 10 years, concurrent with all the discoveries of relevant markers, is how do you put it together so it becomes practical to just have in the everyday flow of a clinician where they don't have to work hard? Because one thing, doctors and other medical professionals work really hard to get their license. And so generally, they're not going to do anything that makes them look silly in front of a patient. So if they aren't sure about the data they're getting, they're probably not going to bring it to you or use it. In fact, they'll just stick to what they really feel they know and wait for it to catch up. So there's an old saying in medicine, medicine advances the death of one doctor at a time. And the other stats that always stuck in my mind is whatever treatment a doctor prescribes for you,
right,
strongly correlates with the year they got out of medical school. And it makes sense because you get out of medical school and you're like on the front lines of Vietnam with bullets whizzing over here. You're not going to go sit down and do a bunch of research or get current all the time. If you're super dedicated, you may pull down some scientific citation on one interesting case you saw that week. But mostly you're just cranking through a bunch of 10-minute appointments.
I mean, I see the diplomas on the wall, but I don't know where they finished in their class. You know, I mean, they may have just made it. I don't know. So the technology is only going to be as useful as the people who can interpret it and then make it practical. I certainly get that. Right now, let's talk about some areas that maybe, you know, an ordinary person getting a medical checkup might benefit from. What's going on right now that AI has changed?
So you get some strong opinions, and there's two kind of general schools of thought around AI. One was what I call the Babylon Health from 5 or 6 years ago, where Babylon said, all right, this bot is going to replace the doctor ultimately. Now they changed that a bit, but back in the day when they first came up, that was the whole idea, is that you don't need a doctor anymore. Eventually AI is going to get so good that they'll be able to diagnose you. And, you know, in a lot of cases, an AI can sort through diagnoses pretty well. The second school is called human in the loop. And it means that the Babylon bot should have actually been the assistant to a human doctor, and that the human doctor has the call ultimately, but uses the information and it helps them shortcut and get through things really quickly. So from a practical standpoint, I think the apparatus can be constructed around a doctor to free them up from administrivia and other sorting through things. And they can just focus on being people with their patients. And almost have that coach-athlete relationship that generally gets the best results. And so if we can free doctors up from being administrators or entering things in the computer or this and that to practice medicine, I think that's going to be a win-win for everybody. If it becomes that we just get rid of humans and your Dr. Bot will see you now, I think that's a little bit more dystopian in my opinion.
It's always seemed to me, I wonder whether you agree, that the practice of medicine is part science and part art. Do you think that AI has the potential to narrow or change the balance of that? What you described is that, in effect, it seems to me. The doctor is the human player in this. The machine is the tool. Will that process be enhanced, or will that art-science divide be eliminated?
I think if you set it up to where the AI has guardrails and it knows its role, and that the human knows the role of the AI, it will be a net benefit, because you'll have expanded medical care and access to professionals. And instead of saying the human has to do 100% of the task, you take away the 90% that could be automated or done by a bot. And that 10% that is left is the really intense, smart, creative art part of that you just described of the practice. And the other thing is, when you really get down to it, and part of our testing results, the most fascinating part of that has been that we are now seeing almost an explicit link, because when we're running this test, it's holistic across all your body systems. And you can generally see that a lot of, conditions actually have a cognitive and behavioral link. And so, for example, we have our autism test has a 99% accuracy profile based on the biomarkers. And what we see in a lot of those patients is they have comorbidities, and it turns out that there's a lot of the metabolites that come out of the dietary processes show some toxic compounds are fed and all that. And so And it basically affected the brain formation and whatnot. So you're having this gut-mind link, and then it's surfacing early stages, and we still have to validate a lot of this, but there is definitely a link to what's going on with the rest of your body and cognition and behavioral health.
Our guest is Jim Keane. He's the CEO of Molecular U. He's here to tell us, give us the benefit of his expertise in the area of technology and medicine and the intersection, and what artificial intelligence may, present in the future here. When Bones would come in and someone was lying on the gurney, he would do his diagnostic
wave the wand
with the wand, and the wand would tell him everything that was wrong. Is that science fiction, or is that a potential future for us?
I mean, you kind of do that with MRIs and other imaging right now. It's just a really intense process, and you don't have a hand MRI and whatnot. So you could see logically, if you get really good with the magnetics and the other aspects on the hardware, that's where it could go. And the imaging, for example, I saw a really interesting company about 5 years ago. And this entrepreneur had collected, I think, about 5 or 6 million scans, MRIs of somebody's brains. And they have unified medical records there. So they were able to match it to qualitative assessments of mental capabilities as far as progression from like early stage dementia all the way to full blown Alzheimer's. And then he matched it up to brain shape. And so that was pretty interesting. But the only way he was able to do that was using machine learning and AI technologies to rapidly classify brain shape, like this shape of a brain seems to correspond with early stage dementia. So I think that's perfect areas where you can do that. Now, getting back to Dr. McCoy, you know, you've seen the march of how we've reduced how many tubes of blood are needed and whatnot down to a almost like a Theranos-like mythical small tube.
That was my next question. I would most people find out a lot about their condition through blood work, drawing of blood, a couple of vials. We know the Elizabeth Holmes debacle and the fraud and the claims that she made concerning her technology that was going to panel all kinds of things with a drop of blood. It turned out to not be true. Will AI make her vision real if it's not already?
So if you think about it, the dominant paradigm on blood testing for, you know, many, many decades has been you'll take the sample of blood and you'll run a bunch of chemicals against it to get the diagnostic outreads like cholesterol or glucose or insulin, things like that. And it's been very single biomarker. So they'll look at your glucose and say, oh, well, it kind of looks like you're diabetic. But it's not seeing, okay, you're diabetic, but you also have all these underlying comorbidities that are arising. And there's very little comparison about the interrelationships between the biomarkers. We take a totally different approach because there's so many markers and that influence. We see them as clusters or families of markers between 10 and 20, for example, in Alzheimer's. And how all those relate to each other, you know, the mathematical precision of where each marker is and then where it is relative to everything else. It's more like a bioprint. And there's just no way you can hand calculate that. You need to use AIs to go through these sophisticated prints that come out to give you insight into conditions like Alzheimer's, depression's another one, rheumatoid arthritis, various cancers across the board. And increasingly, they all interrelate with each other, and you couldn't do that without AI either.
Is it safe to say that the things that we have been working on, looking for causes and treatments, would have taken decades and decades longer to be successful on it were it not for the emergence of very powerful artificial intelligence machines?
Yeah, and I think everybody's kind of apprehensive or not quite sure where it's going to go, but you got to realize it's just really at the early stage. And they're just really beginning to harness this, but also it's gotten really inexpensive to run like proteome metabolome tests. And that shows you the function and what's going on right now. And I can give you a great example. One of our biggest wins in the last year is we had one of our longtime subscribers, and she was very, practiced a lot of just classic health and wellness approaches. And when she gets suggestions after she got her test results from us, she'd work on her things to move those markers. And then her last test came in and the markers lined up and it spit out a high risk profile for pancreatic cancer. And that one, I don't know if you know of it, but it is a mass cancer and it generally doesn't surface until you're about three months from dying. So it's known as a death sentence cancer. And this one we found, she had three small lesions. It was surgical intervention was likely. You didn't have to do chemo radiation. And it was caught early. It was a stage one. In fact, the clinician said, I've never seen a stage one pancreatic cancer. And so just running that regular screening surfaced that. And she had the intervention. And we just reran that test with her to see what her markers were doing post-surgery. And they've all gone back to normal.
It's incredibly exciting.
Yeah. But think about it. If you look healthy on the surface, you don't get asked to get tested. And if there's no symptoms, you're not going to go probe further because medicine is kind of in a hurry. That's how they get paid. So if you think about it, we need to kind of completely shift to what if you got a test like this once or twice a year and you had this long running set of tests and they cost about $100. And it would go over 26 to 50 biological systems in your body, give you the readout, tell you how they're interacting with each other. And anything starts forming even 5 or 10 years, early stage, pre-symptomatic, you would basically save the system a lot of money, and you would also avoid a lot of individual human suffering.
Fascinating. Jim Keen, CEO of Molecular U. Jim, I could go on forever, but just this last thing, there's a recent article in The New Yorker about the impact or the potential for artificial intelligence to treat mental health, mental disorders. And from the article, they talk about there are millions of people now who have apps on their phone, Happify and Replicate, where cognitive behavior programs that help people with their either depression or anxiety. Do you see a role for artificial intelligence in the treatment of mental health?
I kind of go both ways here. So whenever I think about AIs, what you're talking about is forming a brain. And the way a good AI gets formed is a training set. And so the richer and deeper the training set is. So giving you a good example, Walmart archives trailing 20 years of phone calls to ask a pharmacist. And if you converted that, because they get millions of calls a year, if you converted all that, you would have a pretty almost Turing-like bot to answer mm-hmm. pharmacy questions, because that's a great training set, right?
Yep.
But if you have a limited training set, then you're really quickly can go off the rails as far as bias.
Sure.
You know, maybe you go into a practice where all they do is treat one type of patient and there's only about 200 of them, right? So it really is the training set part. And
it's still garbage in, garbage out.
Yeah. And then the other thing, if you think about it, like ChatGPT, everybody's on fire about that. And then in June, you had a couple studies posted because you were starting to see the advent of poisoned AIs. And what the term meant was when they analyzed it, they realized that the AIs in their training set had started gobbling up, bot-generated content. And
bots were talking to other bots.
Yeah. So because now websites that are getting crawled for content on a regular basis to form the training set for the general AI has increasingly had a shift of bot-generated content, like copywriting is done on product sites.
Right. We can't have the bots talking to the bots as being the only source of information, right?
Yeah, and at a certain percentage, it poisons the AI. The results start going off the rails, and they start hallucinating more. And like one computer science friend of mine who has fairly pungent turn of voice, he said, yeah, you had the bots running around eating other bot shit, you know? So, right? So it's a poor diet.
Of course.
And what they concluded is, and this is where it should give you hope, is that high quality AIs can only, it's like having a tree growing over a pure spring of water, right? That spring of water is human content generated by humans. We still produce the most outlandish, creative, subtle, deep things. And the bots need that to be healthy bots and to grow and not be poisoned AIs. So it really comes down to, back to your question, is where are they getting their training sets? Is it wide enough to get rid of bias and statistical, fastening on a particular topic and whatnot? Mm-hmm. And I don't know where they would get the CBT or anything like that to train the bot and then have responsive questions. So I'm a show me state type of guy on that one.
See where it's going. Jim Keen, people want more information about Molecular U. What should they do?
Well, we're a Vancouver-based company. I live in Portland, Oregon right now, and I'm in the process of setting up our U.S. operations to come to market here. So we're not commercially available in the United States, but if you want to learn what we're doing, our website's great. It's www.molecularu.com. That's molecularyou.com. And we will be making our market entry in the next couple of years. And we're available in Canada right now.
Jim, thanks so much. There's so much to learn. And it's often hard to get your head around it, but it is something absolutely worth keeping an eye on. Artificial intelligence, given how actual intelligence seems to be failing us. So thanks so much for joining us on The Corner. I'd love to have you back real soon.
Steve, anytime. This was delightful, and I really enjoyed getting to know you as well.
Appreciate it. Thanks, Jim. Hey, the rest of you, thank you as well. Don't forget, follow us, like us, subscribe, do the whole thing. We appreciate it. The Behavioral Corner. See you next time. Bye-bye.
Retreat Behavioral Health has proudly been serving the community for over 10 years. Here at Retreat, we believe in the power of connection and quality care. We offer comprehensive, holistic, and compassionate treatment from industry-leading experts. Call 855-802-6600 or visit us at www.retreatbehavioralhealth.com to begin your journey today.
That's it for now. And make us a habit, hanging out at the Behavioral Corner. And when we're not hanging, follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter on the Behavioral Corner.